From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, a new study shows Milwaukee nonprofits are beginning to thrive once again. Later, what we can learn about living a good life from people who are dying.
Doing grief counseling with people who are dying, you really quickly get to the point of zooming out and seeing the big picture, what really matters, and putting it in perspective, and then laughing together about the true joys in life.
Plus, what traffic engineers might do to make roads work better for traffic.
If we're going to do something, kind of like landing a man on the moon, you're going to have to spend the money to do it. So let's instead of putting a man on the moon, let's get a man to the supermarket on time or a woman to her office on time.
And writer Andrea Locken's heroine relives a year and tries to figure out what to change. Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. This is Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's great to have you listening on this Monday. It was described as a perfect storm, the interaction between the Great Recession and nonprofit organizations. Giving was down to nonprofits at exactly the time when many of their services were needed the most. The economic recovery has been slow in coming, but new research shows Milwaukee area nonprofits are in a much stronger position than they were just a couple of years ago. The research was undertaken by the newspaper Biz Times in collaboration with a journalism class at UW-Milwaukee. Executive editor Steve Jagler joins us now, along with journalism students James Gutierrez and Samantha Nash. Welcome to all three of you.
Thanks for having us.
The results of this research seem pretty favorable on the whole for nonprofits. Is that an accurate depiction if you had to sum up the overall tone of this report?
I think the people within the nonprofit industry were mostly surprised at the number of nonprofits, 62%, that say they have recovered from the Great Recession. We really didn't know what to expect going into this. So the fact that so many say they've recovered and so many expect to have more donations in 2013 than they did in 2012, I think those numbers were surprising.
Well, and it seemed like the numbers were, if not overwhelming, certainly convincing that you were actually depicting a trend. It was not ambiguous.
I'd say that's the case.
How many nonprofits did you survey for this?
We had responses from 79 out of a database of 120 or so. 79 nonprofit executives responded.
And this is obviously not every single nonprofit group in the Milwaukee area, but were you pretty satisfied that the research yielded a representative cross-section of the sector?
Yeah, I think so. We had groups from a lot of different organizations all across the board. And just today, actually, I was reading up a little bit more. I guess as far as the top 30 cities nationwide, Milwaukee was actually ranked top of the list for median charitable donations, which is pretty interesting, and I thought that really validated our research even that much more, which is really cool to see that.
What do we know about how the economy affects nonprofits versus other sectors of the community?
Well, I think with this recession recovery, we've seen a lot of stagnation in terms of job growth. But I think seeing the growth that's happened in the nonprofit industry really gives a little bit more indication of how businesses are doing, because a lot of nonprofits get their biggest contributions from businesses. So even though businesses are running a little bit leaner and not hiring as many people, they're still making more charitable donations than they were maybe 3 years ago.
I think, Mitch, the survey illustrated how the nonprofit sector was affected in a similar way that the for-profit sector was. Most of the nonprofits we talked to, they had to do more with less because there was less available. So they had to collaborate. The recurring phrase we kept hearing is, we have to do more with less. And that certainly has been true in the private sector.
Well, and along the lines of collaboration, that seemed to be one of the salient points, that collaboration started when the recession was at its worst. But it sounds like they are persisting even today, that collaboration goes on even as these nonprofit groups have recovered. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd say so. And I'd say it was a matter of necessity and survival for the nonprofits that made it through those darker, leaner times. Collaboration was a matter of survival.
The collaborative nature of everything was really interesting, especially the people that we talked to. They all knew they needed to buy in. But one of the numbers that I saw that kind of jumped out at me, because of things when we were going over questions, Samantha had this group discussion about what questions were we interested in, and the idea of volunteering came up. And I think that we have these numbers that show that we're doing great as far as raising money, They're expecting more money. But at the same time, the collaboration between the community and the nonprofits is something that I think we can still strive for, because over 80% in the survey said that they needed more volunteers. So as much as the business community is doing to raise money, I think it's something that the communities in general, just with manpower, can get out there and support these nonprofits just as much.
Steve, I know your newspaper in the past has reported on, all of us did this when the recession was at its worst, this perfect storm, the idea that nonprofits were struggling at a time when their services were needed more than ever. Did the results of this indicate to you that those nonprofits are pulling out of that perfect storm? Are they now able to start serving more people than they were?
It's a moving target, to be sure. They do expect increased donations in 2013, more than they received in 2012. But I don't think any of them are spinning cartwheels in the streets about where they're at. And the recession certainly created a greater need for core services, human services, food, health care, as benefits. People lost their benefits. And nonprofits across the board were affected by it, because what happened then is the donors that were still giving recognized that the core services were what was needed. That put greater pressure on the nonprofits for the arts, for instance. They became less of a priority in the recession, and that came back to us in the survey.
Samantha and James, what were the specific kinds of questions that you asked when you reached out to these nonprofits?
We really tried to focus, first of all, on their own self-assessment, how they felt that they were doing and how they felt they had recovered. And then we tried to follow it up with questions about their staffing, about what kinds of resources they needed, whether they needed additional space, additional people. And one of the bigger ones was whether or not they needed more people or better people on their board of trustees to get things motivated and get things happening within their organization.
Well, and what did you hear along those lines?
73% said that they need more effective board members. So it's definitely a concern among nonprofits, I think, getting people at the top out there and fundraising, making connections and all of that.
James, were there other questions that you think drove at this question in a way that this issue in a way that maybe hadn't been asked so much?
I mean, I think it was pretty comprehensive. And we got a lot of people on the phone as well, and we got to talk to them. Another thing that we did talk about, though, was just the changing landscape that puts people in touch with nonprofits. Over 70% of them stated that they needed more effective marketing or social media plans or identities, trying to get that presence out there. You know, we're all plugged in somehow. I mean, if people are listening to this, you're plugged in somehow. So I think that's just something that going forward, they would like to do better, just getting connected to people.
Steve Jagler, did you go back and speak with the nonprofit leaders after the results of the survey became known?
Yes, we surveyed the individual nonprofits, and then the students went back and interviewed some people who are involved in the nonprofit industry, people at the Donors Forum, Greater Milwaukee Foundation, United Way, and so forth, to get their interpretation of the results, since they are living it day to day and seeing it. They're on the front lines of it. It was interesting to get their reaction to the numbers that our survey showed.
Well, was it an eye opener to those people who are experts in the field? Did they realize that these trends were the case?
I think there was a lot of surprise, actually, that things were shaping up to be so positive. I think with a lot of the news, especially related to the rate of unemployment in the country, I think there's a sense that things are still not so good. And so our survey results really kind of showed that, you know, things are turning around in a lot of ways. I think it was kind of a surprise.
Was it a surprise to you?
Yeah, I'd say the numbers were more optimistic than what I would have expected them to be. I think it speaks to just how resourceful the nonprofits in the Milwaukee area had to be and have to be and will be.
Can you talk about how this collaboration came together? How did BizTimes happen to this project with journalism students?
Good question. The stars just all lined up in a row for this situation. I was asked for the first time to teach this advanced course at UWM, my alma mater. So I was happy to give it a go and see where it took us. And I think the students and I literally learned as we went along. But we had this database of the BizTimes nonprofit directory with 120 nonprofits in it. And I threw it to the students, you know, as a final project for the class. What could we do with this? And it was one of the students actually that came up with the grand idea of, well, let's ask them if they rebounded from the recession. And from there, the students divided up the nonprofits by the letters in the alphabet, and they appointed a captain who was Samantha to be kind of the lead student on the project. And she was kind of the traffic cop. And then they each reached out to their designated or nonprofits within the survey findings. And so they each needed to rely upon the other. It was a great teamwork exercise. But I'd rather have them talk about what they learned from the whole process. So, well, Sam, what did you get out of it?
I think it was a really unique opportunity. It was unlike anything else that I've done in school so far, in that it involved such a large scale of collaboration with area organizations as well as my classmates. One of the things that was really neat about this class is that we had the opportunity to interview a lot of people from area businesses in addition to all of these nonprofits. So when it came time to do these interviews and come up with questions, we already had a really good understanding of some of the business trends, particularly that you know, nonprofits kind of rely on businesses and that there's a very symbiotic relationship between them. So, I think it was unique and very awesome to take part in.
How did the collaboration play out as far as your journalism experience goes?
Well, I've had a couple really good experiences so far with the whole journalism field and pretty much getting experiences under my belt. But I think to come together with a bunch of people that are kind of just going at it, first timers, kind of just trying to get an understanding of things and working together, and the spirit of collaboration was really, really great. I think doing it at a school like UWM, where it's more like a commuter school, so there's a naturally like this kind of a distance if you want to keep your distance from other students in the class. It was really, really fun to come together in that way.
Well, James, Steve, Sam, thank you so much, and congratulations on putting this whole survey together.
Thanks for having us.
Steve Jagler is executive editor at the newspaper Biz Times. James Gutierrez and Samantha Nash are journalism students at UW-Milwaukee and are members of the class that collaborated with Biz Times on new research about the economic health of Milwaukee area nonprofits. There is a link to the study from WUWM.com/lake effect. A Wisconsin grief counselor says we can learn a lot about life from people facing death. We'll learn what some of those lessons are and more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Last year, Lake Effect broadcast a series of conversations about death and dying in the modern world. It turns out, for most of us in the U.S., where death often happens away from home, we tend to shy away from talking about the inevitable. Cherie Milton says, in avoiding talking about death, we're missing an opportunity to learn about life. As a grief counselor and family therapist, Milton has spent the last several years helping patients and their families at Dane County's largest hospice, a Grace Hospice Care. She says each of her patients and their families have approached dying in different ways and taught her what makes for a good death and a good life. She's collected these stories in a new book called Before You Go, Stories for a Better Life from Those Facing Death. She tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce why she wrote the book.
As I begin to do the work as a grief counselor, the patients and their families and being exposed to that sacred time was literally having a huge impact on how I was living my life. I was so affected and realized what really matters and learned how the smaller, trivial things really I could let go when I realized how short life could be and how precious it was.
Well, tell us about some of these lessons that you learned from patients. What was one of the most memorable realizations that you had?
The first story is one of the most powerful for me. This woman, who was in her late 50s, had ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, as we know it by. And that is a disease that just keeps taking things from you. You lose your ability to do anything for yourself. And it's sometimes a slow, very painful, emotionally painful to experience that. And this woman that I dealt with, even though she knew she was dying, she didn't want to die, and she had losses every day. She couldn't feed herself. She couldn't talk. And yet, somehow, every time I visited her, she would find something to be grateful for. And it would just move me so deeply, her ability to have gratitude and be thankful. And even at the end, when she could do nothing, the last time I met with her, she talked about how she didn't want to die and she'd lost everything, but she was so grateful that they couldn't take away her tears. She could still cry and express her emotions about her circumstances. And I was just undone. I was forever changed. I thought, man, I'm going to quit complaining about stupid stuff.
How do you deal with it when you're counseling these patients and their families? I would imagine that, you know, can be frustrating sometimes to feel like you don't have a right to complain about anything because look at what's going on with your patients.
That's true. And it's a balance. As a hospice worker and a grief counselor, I have great peers and co-workers that they understand that we all have that need sometimes just to vent and decompress and you know, spend a little bit of time whining. And yet, much quicker, they help me and I help them get ready to see the big picture. Doing grief counseling with people who are dying, you really quickly get to the point of zooming out and seeing the big picture, what really matters, and putting it in perspective, and then laughing together about the true joys in life and working with this population.
What was the most difficult lesson that you've learned? I mean, what was the most difficult story that you put in this book for you to write and to share with others?
The most difficult for me is the chapter that tells the story of informing two elementary age children that their mom was going to die. This family had been very open with their children that the mom had cancer, but they had not gotten to the point where they really explained to them that the cancer was not going to get better and that she was going to die. And telling those two little ones and watching the daughter literally melt on the floor sobbing probably was the hardest thing I've ever done. And just so powerful to see children just react with such compassion and yet such so much emotion to realize this mother that they loved and needed was not going to be there in a few months.
But ultimately, you write, it was the right thing to do to tell these children that they were going to lose their mom.
Absolutely. The evidence is pretty clear that the best outcomes almost always are when we are honest with children. Of course, keeping it age appropriate. But for these two school-aged children, when they found out the truth, they were able to have the support to process their emotions, to say what they wanted to say to their mommy, to have the support and openness in their school and in their neighborhood. And it really, it's tragic that she died, but it was such a triumphant, good outcome to see people rally around these children. They learned a lot about support and community.
I mean, that's the thing that I feel like is so difficult in reading these stories is this idea that the outcome isn't going to be happy, really.
Right.
Ultimately.
Right.
But your work is really about making it as good as it possibly can be.
That's right. It seems contradictory to say that it was a good death, but at a grace, we understand in working with this population, that is a true statement. There can be good deaths. No, we don't have the ability to bring the loved one back, and we can't change the disease process. But we can help when families allow us to come alongside and give them the best possible death that they can experience, where the family feels supported, they feel that this tragic event is pulling them closer and not pulling them apart, and it leaves them set up to be much healthier in their survivorship as they grieve the loss of their loved one.
Of course, in not every story does the patient or the patient's family take your advice and take your counseling and make the necessary changes to have that good death. One of the stories that's coming to mind as we're talking about this is that of Mary,
right,
who kind of up until the end wouldn't even accede to her own comfort. She was dying, and yet she refused to lay down.
That's right. And it's such a powerful image still for me. I see this older woman sitting up in her hospital bed and refused to lay down to make herself more comfortable, because she really took on that physical posture that if I lay down, that means I've given up and I'm going to die. And as the book describes, she actually did die sitting up, resting on her bedside table. You know, and that was such a lesson for me at her strength and perseverance, that's what she held true to right to the end. Even though my opinion was she could have been a lot more comfortable physically, emotionally, but we really have to just meet the patient where they're at, physically, emotionally, spiritually. And obviously we can only companion them to the degree they allow us to. So when they're resistant, we typically accept the fact that we may never understand their resistance to accept, process, try to make their last weeks or months as best as they can. And we have to just accept that. Hard for us to understand and for her family, but it was what fit for her.
And so what lesson do you take from that to apply to your daily life?
That power of both a fighter. She was a fighter, and she fought right till the end. In the end, she died how she lived. And I really learned that to expect huge change at the end, or to expect myself or others in my life to make big changes when it's contrary to how they've lived up to that point, is probably an unrealistic expectation. And so it helps me to align my expectations of others.
Were there stories, were there experiences that changed how you thought of the grieving process, that helped you in future cases to change how you counsel your patients?
There is. There's a few of the stories that I tell in the book. In dealing with patients and families, those that seem to be wired to be more expressive and process all of the losses that were happening as their loved one was diagnosed and dying, as they talked about the death and processed their grief, it really taught me how after the death, for many of these individuals, their grief process was not as intense. And it was interesting how others would accuse them of being in denial or not really dealing with it. And I realized, no, I think that when people have opportunity to really process it before the death even happens, it does tend to influence and lessen the intensity of the grief they experience later.
So we shouldn't necessarily judge people by how they're expressing their grief?
Absolutely. Grief is so unique and individual, and that can trip us up because we expect others to process and deal with it like we would or like others have. And then that's isolating, because people that are grieving will express, hey, it's not like that for me. It's different. And they need that permission and freedom to have that difference.
There's a story about another child that you helped counsel, Ricky, and you talk about how his expression of his grief, obviously, again, as a child being age appropriate, was this kind of shadow grief. And I want to have you explain that concept and tell us, does that apply to adults as well?
It does. And that idea of shadow grief, for Ricky, he didn't necessarily express and articulate that he missed his brother and that he was sad that his brother died. He began to grieve and talk about the things that his brother represented, the roles that his brother played. For example, his brother always helped him to know what was the right bus to get on for school because they had several identical buses that would come by. And so Ricky was tearful and finally exclaimed, "I'm going to get in trouble because I don't have anyone to tell me which bus to get on now." And so it was the shadow of all the other things that his big brother represented to him. And adults are the same way. And we call that associated losses, secondary losses. A person dies and we grieve that person, but we also grieve all the roles and responsibilities and daily tasks that that person typically did. And now they're gone and we have to find a new normal.
What kind of lessons are in these stories for people who are caring for somebody who's dying? I mean, what lessons would you point them to say, here is something you can take with you as you go through this difficult journey?
I think as they read through the stories, it helps them to gain perspective that, yes, it's hard and it's sad and there's probably no magic way to turn that around, but it can be good. It can be enriching. It can influence our future, that there is hope. It can help set new direction. And it also helps individuals who are caregiving not to feel alone. As they read through the stories, they realize many others have gone down this journey.
Do you think that these kinds of lessons are often heard, that people really would apply and put them into practice in our lives? Do you think people can do that?
I think they can. And what I'm told over and over is people will tell me, "I didn't get it until all of a sudden I had someone close to me who was dying or died." And by reading through the book, my hope was that all of the individuals that I want to say, "Hey, you need to come and spend a month at work with me, that'll give you perspective." Obviously, they can't do that. But if they read some of the stories, it helps them to have that front row seat. If we just pause and let ourselves consider, I think we can. I think we can learn and appreciate and have better lives on a daily basis from those who aren't getting that chance because they are watching their days and decline. And so we, as I say at work, any day that I'm not a patient is a great day.
Well, Sheree Milton, thank you so much for sharing these stories and Before You Go with us.
You are so welcome. I'm just delighted that you would ask me.
Sheree Milton is a family therapist and grief counselor at A Grace Hospice Care in Madison. Her new book is called Before You Go, Stories for a Better Life from Those Facing Death. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce, and you can learn more about the book from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Driving a smarter car might involve driving your current car on a smarter road. We'll talk smart road technology when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. We spend a lot of time trying to make our driving experience more comfortable through changes to our cars. But it turns out the changes someday could involve not having to drive them at all. That is the notion that some advocates and developers of so-called smart road technology have in mind. But smart roads don't involve just driverless cars. It could mean better timing for stoplights or, at a more basic level, turning over some decisions drivers make to a larger traffic management entity. Auto contributor Mark Savage joined Lake Effect's Dan Harmon recently to talk about smart roads.
Smart streets are having street smarts these days in the technical world for cars. There are a lot of different things that are coming down the road, if you'll pardon that pun, that will make it easier maybe for us to see at night and also easier for us to get around. But the sad part, of course, is that all of this would cost money. What it means is there are people out there developing new technologies that'll make whether it's road signs easier to see or the lines on the roads easier to see, things like that, or via GPS get us around to where we need to go a little quicker.
All right. Well, the first thing that came to mind when you mentioned smart streets to me was the idea of driverless cars. Is that something that
Well, that's something I know was a Google, I think, is working on that and a few others to try and get that to happen. And, well, you know it's possible. But again, there are so many of us who already are driving our cars, then we're going to have to mix those driverless cars in with that. And obviously, just like hybrids have taken a while to catch on and they're small numbers, these will be small numbers. They'll be pricey. Are they going to work by themselves or will they need sensors in the highways and the roads to make them go? That if that's the case, then we're talking major money and more than some of the things that I wanted to talk about here today.
Okay.
They're already going to be pricey enough, I'm sure. And we're struggling right now to get people to support any kind of gas taxes to pay for roads. You know,
right.
We think they should all be perfect, but we don't want to pay anything for them.
Well, I asked about the driverless cars because supposedly they will not require sensors in the roads or this whole sensor infrastructure. It will be almost entirely GPS-based.
And that's the way it's going to have to go, I think, to be even remotely possible. And when I say remotely possible, I'm guessing by the time I'm dead, maybe they'll be around. I don't know.
All right. So another pun, by the way, with remotely. Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Well, tell us about the – because you mentioned sensors. So what will sensors allow – either planners or traffic planners to do then?
Well, there are a variety of things. I think the sensors – more and more cars have GPS at this point, or you can buy it and stick it in your car. Like I'm driving a Jeep Grand Cherokee today. That has the system in it that tells you what traffic is happening in front of you. So as I was coming downtown here, I could see that it was yellow, so it was slow in certain spots. It tells you it's red if it's a blockage and it's green if it's fine. So that's the first step, is getting to people to know what – roads are holding for us ahead so that we know whether we're going to go a different route or not. Some things that sensors will do in cars and along the highways is allow it so that stoplights could change ahead of time. You know, if we're starting to get traffic backups, stoplights could go ahead and change and go green. And I know we were talking before the show here about Las Vegas has some of this. Obviously, it also helps if you're in good weather where sensors are going to be less prone to dying or having snow or rain or something that would affect them. This is just to help traffic flow. And you think to yourself how many times, you know, it's construction season here in Wisconsin. All sorts of roads are backed up. All sorts of roads are under construction. And if you could start rerouting people or have traffic lights that help get people on and off the highways and on the main roads a little easier, those are real doable things. It's just, again, everything costs money and how much time and effort are we going to put into this?
And just for people who aren't aware of Las Vegas and what they're doing, I saw it on some PBS documentary, which I can't remember the name of, but they did illustrate it pretty well what they do. They don't even have sensors. What they have is traffic monitors. They have people monitoring various traffic spots around the city via camera. But then the traffic monitors have the ability to actually manipulate light timing so that if traffic is too severe, too backed up, they can just say, turn them all green and – there you go. So it's not even – it's pretty low tech in a way.
Well, right, and that's it. Low tech is good, and that actually could happen quicker if we put cameras up everywhere. And certainly there's some cameras on the freeways now. We know that they're out there watching the traffic, and you know they tell us it's 18 minutes from here to the zoo interchange or whatever the case may be. So you know that that's possible. Again, it requires some investment.
But that's the difference being that when we have the traffic monitors telling us how much – time it takes to get downtown, that allows us to make the decision to find a different route, you know, and who knows if that other route is a better route. That's
right.
What you don't really know.
The other route may be under construction is why everybody's on the highway right,
right.
now.
Which if there was active monitoring of cameras and they had the ability to change lights, that would actually...
Right. That's more active and certainly could smooth things out considerably. I think it's funny in our country we worry so much about the EPA numbers on our cars and trucks and so forth, yet there's been very little done so far to try and smooth out traffic flow, which, as we all know, as the car is moving, it's very efficient compared to when it's stopping and going all the time.
Does there – okay, this may be a little off subject, but does there need to be some kind of paradigm shift in traffic design? Because stoplights go in when intersections are dangerous or they're viewed as safer for pedestrians, but traffic lights don't keep traffic moving. It slows everything down. And that's viewed as good. Does that viewpoint need to change?
Well, I think you do have to look, especially main roads and so forth. I mean, I understand that the reason there's a stop sign at the end of my street in my neighborhood is because they want me to slow down because there's people on foot, there's bicycles, there's kids. That makes sense. But I think in traffic lights in particular on main roads, you know, you think around here, Mayfair Road, let's say, or Blue Mound Road. You know, why is it that I go 1 mile and then I stop and then I go another half a mile and then I stop and then I go 2 miles and then I stop? If you could set it so that if we're going the speed limit, 45 or so, and you can keep going, it's going to be much more efficient, get people through the intersections and keep people both moving, getting places on time. Isn't that a novel thought here in the summer? And also saving gas. So I think it is. It's a paradigm shift, but I think the whole nation has to come to grips with if we're going to do something, kind of like landing a man on the moon, you know, you're going to have to spend the money to do it. So let's instead of putting a man on the moon, let's get a man to the supermarket on time or a woman to her office on time.
Imagine
that.
Even making most of the lights would be just the revolution,
yeah,
really.
You don't have to celebrate every time you make one.
Yeah, and that people may not – the thing that to me – this is another complete aside, but when you get a yellow light, people don't want to stop. They want to gun it and go through it, which is really unsafe. So – it seems that even lights are unsafe for that reason as well.
Well, yes, I saw that today. And actually, I think what you've seen in our area here is more rotaries being put in. And those are very good. There's one on my way to work every morning. And it is amazing how much quicker I get through that intersection than I used to, because it used to back up both day and night different directions. And so therefore, it slowed you down because it was a four-way stop before that. So, right. Rotaries, I think, certainly have their place too.
Okay. You mean traffic circles? Yeah.
Traffic circles, yes.
Well, let's get back to smart streets, which I think most of us would concede that ours are dumb streets in many ways. So you mentioned something before about glass.
Right. There's another project, I think they're working on it out in Idaho, that involves real high-strength glass. I'm sure it's a weave of some sort that they put sensors into. And the sensors that go in there then are basically heat sensors that – and as soon as it starts to snow or sleet, these would turn on and heat up the pavement being this glass structure. I don't know what the cost is for that. I'm sure it's higher than putting in blacktop or asphalt, as the case may be. But again, you think to yourself, how much money do we spend on plows and plowing all the roads in the wintertime and salt? And, it's pretty well assumed that salt doesn't help the environment. It doesn't help the cars. It doesn't help the roads. So, maybe you start figuring out ways where you can get a road that will actually melt itself. I mean, we all know there's heated sidewalks even in some places in downtown Milwaukee where they turn these on and, gee, now you don't have to worry about the ice buildup. So that's another thing that would be both a safety thing and I think possibly over time would be something that would pay for itself in less maintenance for the roads themselves. Then there's other safety things. I mean, 3M is working constantly. I was just up there for another thing I was working on recently, and they were showing us all the reflective materials that they have for clothing. But obviously, they've done a lot in the way of signs already that make us so that we can see them further and further down the road. There's talk of a kind of a sun-gathering strip that you can put down for the highways, and this isn't necessarily 3M, but I know several people are working on this, where you put this down to line the highways, and it gathers the sunlight during the day, and then it reflects it off for 10 to 12 hours every night. So now you can see the roads better. Maybe you don't have to put up as many streetlights. Maybe out in the country, it's easier to see the highway than it is, has been in the past. So I think that's another, little technology. I think that one's a much more doable one. To me, it reminds me of the little stars and things you used to put on the kids' room and, when they were little and let them light up and let them watch those all night as they glow in the dark.
Yeah, glow in the dark road. There we go.
Glow in the dark road. All What's wrong with that?
Well, something this may not be as much of a smart road as it would be nice if it would be this way. But as far as the longevity of roads and the condition they get in, especially in snow states, but potholes and that kind of fissures and cracks, I mean, are these things that are there technological solutions or are there smart solutions to make roads just last better or more easily repairable?
I know there are folks out there working on this, and some of it is they grind up tires and put them in there so that there's more rubber in them, and either it can increase the longevity of the road or it can also actually make it so that you have a little less rolling resistance on it. So, over time, maybe you get a little better gas mileage out of the cars. So I know that's being studied. Again, it comes down to who's going to put the money and effort into doing more than a 1 mile test strip here and there to see how this works. So, you know, I think there's a lot of hope down the road for various new technologies, whether it's for safety, whether it's for longevity, or just smoothing out the traffic flow. I think that there's a lot of good things on the horizon. It just comes down to when we're going to get around to actually putting the effort into doing it.
What would you say are the highest priority items for smart roads?
Well, I would say two things. One is something like the lines that glow in the dark. I mean, this is something that would be a safety thing, and I would think that that would be doable fairly quickly and help especially in rural areas. I think, in my mind, working on a sensor system, whether it's reading the cars that go by and measuring the traffic and changing lights and so forth, or whether it's, you know, you got somebody in a room and they're looking at monitors and or sensors to figure this out, I think that's just a, you know, a smart use of what we already have available to us out there, so that you can do something that will make it easier for people to get where they're wanting to go and also save gas along the way.
Just something I noticed, maybe something more regional, but like if you've been in the Pacific Northwest, you know that their roads are the concrete is coarser. Ostensibly, it's just better traction in the rain, and they have reflectors everywhere in the middle of the road, on the side of the road. So at night, you can actually see where you're going in a heavy rain, and they also have hemispherical bumps between the lanes, so that if you're straying, which you don't often be able to see, you'll know that you're straying between lanes. Here, we couldn't do it because the plows would have a field day with those and destroy them all.
The reflectors,
too.
Or the reflectors, right.
So anything here that you think is equivalent that could, I mean, not for rain, but for our weather conditions?
Well, right. I think with snow, it makes it much more difficult because we do have to have an area. Since we don't have glass highways with heat elements in them, we do have to plow and push it off to the side and so forth. I think maybe, like I say, better reflective lines would help. I know down in Florida, of course, they have a lot of reflectors in the pavement also because they get monsoon-like rains from time to time, and so you can still see that. You know, those are the ways to go, and obviously any kind of signage that you can get up along the side of the roads to let people know what's coming up. And, you know, the little bit of high-tech that we have with our little system around Milwaukee where you got the signs up overhead, maybe if they actually updated those more than once every 10 hours, that would probably be helpful too.
Well, thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Dan.
Mark Savage writes about cars for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he is our regular automotive contributor. He talked with Dan Harmon about the concept of smart roads and better traffic management. Savage is also editor of American Snowmobiler magazine and proprietor of a website and Facebook page. Wauwatosa author Andrea Locken's heroine relives a year and tries to figure out what went wrong the first time. We'll learn about her recent novel, When Lake Effect Returns, on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. Every day of every week, almost every hour maybe, includes a decision that will have an impact on you and the people around you. So it is no wonder that we get some of those decisions wrong, maybe some of us more than others. But of all the wrong decisions you've made in the past year, how many of them were so wrong that they've changed the course of your life? And what if you were forced to go back and try again? Wisconsin writer Andrea Locken puts Olive, the heroine of her new novel, The Repeat Year, through just that quandary when Olive wakes up on New Year's Day and finds she's back at the start of 2011. Locken joined us in May to share some more of the story in the Lake Effect studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Mitch. I appreciate it.
And it's great to have you here. What was your inspiration for this book? Did it start with a character or the idea of reliving a year or something else entirely?
It started off with the premise, kind of a what-if question of if somebody could relive a year in their life, would they choose to do things differently? What would that be like? I came up with this idea several years ago and kind of jotted it down in a notebook and didn't come back to it for a long time because I didn't know who was going to be this character that was going to have this opportunity to relive a year of her life. I wanted her to be an everyday heroine, somebody that people could relate to, and I also needed her to have a job that I thought really resonated. And that's how Olive Watson was born, and that's how I came up with the idea of her being an intensive care unit nurse.
There is, of course, as anyone who might glance over the jacket might think, a certain Groundhog Day element at work here, which even Olive, your protagonist, points out.
I wanted to have a little nod to Groundhog Day in the book because I love the movie. It's a hilarious movie. Bill Murray is amazing. And though it does have that similar time event of a character repeating one day, in this case, she points out, well, I wish I was only repeating a day because I don't know if I'm doing it right. I have to live a whole year and not know if I'm immediately making things better.
And there are obviously a lot of distinctions we could make between that movie and this book. But there's another one I think that's worth zeroing in on, this idea of redemption that is at the heart of both. I mean, if you don't mind the comparison, Bill Murray, as funny as he is in Groundhog Day, is not all that sympathetic a character at the start of that movie. Olive Watson is pretty likable. Did you feel a challenge in making her flawed enough to want to relive a year but still sympathetic?
It was a challenge. I think a lot of times when we see this convention of a character getting a second chance, it is an Ebenezer Scrooge or a Phil Connors from Groundhog Day, where the character is just a total jerk and there's nowhere that they can go but up. With Olive Watson, like I said, I wanted her to be relatable. And so I wanted her to be flawed so that there were things that she definitely could improve in her life, mistakes, but that it wasn't totally obvious to her where she'd gone wrong and that she had to analyze her life a little bit more and think about, wow, my actions actually hurt people when I did this, or maybe I thought that this was a good idea at the time, but then I, in hindsight, kind of have a chance to do it over.
They seem like the kind of issues that any of us could encounter over the course of any given year.
I think so. In the case of her being an intensive care nurse unit, for those people who work in the medical profession, or even people just who have interactions with other people on a daily basis in any job, you know, we all wish that we could maybe take back something that we said, or if we had known something in advance, we would have done it a little bit differently.
We should flesh out the plot a bit just to give people more of a flavor for it without giving too much away. What are the issues that Olive at least believes she has to resolve as she relives 2011?
So the huge one is probably that she breaks up with her longtime boyfriend, Phil, and she did something without giving away too much.
Right.
She did something bad, lost his trust, and their relationship is ended and she moves on. And so when she wakes up on New Year's Day, she's in bed with him. And they've been broken up for several months, but he doesn't know anything's wrong because to him, that year hasn't happened yet. And so she has a chance to make things right with him the second time around and to see if they are really meant to be. Another huge issue that she's trying to resolve is patients that she has in the ICU. And so in a few instances, she maybe has a chance to save somebody's life. Other kind of mistakes that she's trying to grapple with are the loss of her best friend, not the death, but the just kind of drifting away.
Right.
Her mother's remarriage, which was a hard thing for her to cope with. And she meets another repeater, Sherry Whitten, who has her own set of mistakes that she's trying to change as well.
Well, and Sherry Whitten, again, without wanting to give it too much away, is kind of her mentor in this whole thing.
She is. She calls her, ironically, her fairy godmother because she's a woman in her late 50s who's friends with her mother, and she's very socially awkward. She just comes out and says whatever she wants to say, regardless of anyone's feelings. And so she and Olive are kind of an unlikely pair as they kind of take this year together.
Well, and I think what all of these various areas that you've talked about have in common is that the changes are not necessarily all that clear cut. In the case of being an intensive care nurse, you know, there are life or death decisions to be made, but they're not simple decisions.
They're not. And this isn't the type of book that takes this magical premise and says she has to save somebody's life or save the president right. or stop an assassination. There's nothing that grandiose in it. It's more the little everyday decisions that we make. And so when she's given this opportunity, initially, she's not even really that happy. She's more confused and disoriented and frustrated. She wants to go back to where she left off. But as she goes through the course of the book and she gets a little bit more into the year, she realizes what an amazing opportunity and blessing it is that she gets to try to do things better.
And I wonder, I don't think it's giving too much away to say that it seems like part of what goes on in this book is how Olive's understanding of what she thinks she needs to change and what she actually needs to change evolves over the course of that year.
I think that's exactly right, is that she starts off with kind of this checklist of these are things that I need to do. And as she attempts those things and realizes that maybe they're still not any better, maybe things are getting even messier and muddier as she goes along, that she maybe had her priorities wrong that first year.
Now, if I have this right, you drafted the book while you were actually earning your MFA at Michigan, right?
Yes, that is correct.
How did the book itself evolve from 2008 to the book that is just coming out?
The very first draft of the repeat year was a hot mess. It wasn't really even making use of the premise. I didn't have much of a plan when I started off. I just kind of had fun. I dove in. I didn't look back. And that resulted in a draft that was a little bit messy, and I wasn't getting the full potential of the repeat year. So the second draft of it changed Olive's profession. I changed her family dynamics a little bit.
What was Olive originally?
Oh, I'm embarrassed to say. She was a receptionist.
Oh, wow.
And clearly, I just wasn't using that very well. So the fact that she became an intensive care nurse, and I changed Phil's profession as well. He started off as a golf pro, and he became a high school science teacher. So a lot of those things changed, and I got lots of feedback in the 5 years of revision from friends and family and agents who I was submitting to at the time, so that by the time my agent finally, I found the agent,
right,
we didn't have much work to do.
You teach creative writing when you are not doing it yourself.
I do.
How do you think working on the process with young writers affects who you are as a writer?
It is so much fun teaching creative writing. My students are just, it's so inspiring to get to work with them, and it really reminds me of myself when I was a young writer at UW-Madison. It really helps to be able to use my experience with writing and revision to remember what it's like for them when they're starting out. They think that they're going to sit down and write a story and get it published immediately. They don't realize that you have to do so much revision. And so it helps to bring me back to that place of, actually, it's a long journey, it's a long path, but if you can keep that original creative spark of excitement that they have, it just reminds me why I do it.
Andrea Locken, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Andrea Locken's novel is called The Repeat Year, and it was published last month by Berkeley. Locken lives in Wauwatosa. She teaches creative writing at UW-Waukesha. She'll talk about her book at an event Wednesday evening at the Hales Corners Public Library. There is a link to more information from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Our interview first aired in May. That's the Monday edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, some questions that should be on all of our minds in the wake of the surveillance and security stories of the last month. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.